Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and he's got his own website, which is themediabeat.us. And we say good morning to David Tarachuk. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us again this morning.
Well, hello. I'm happy to be joining the stalwart Marshall Miles from this week once again, the media capital of the world, New York City, where I am.
All right, and we're going to start off with our fanfare right off the bat.
Well, yes, we have something to fanfare this week, you know, in a week of some tough news, but some good journalism, too. The fanfare this week is for one of our colleagues at NPR, in a week that has drawn heavily on her talents, I have to say. It's Nina Totenberg, a resonant name, right, who's NPR's legal affairs correspondent. So, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court is her beat in a really major way, as the court considered the Mississippi state law that makes abortion illegal at 15 weeks into a pregnancy, highly contentious law, and would arguably threaten to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision of half a century ago, long been seen as what's called settled law for many people. This is just the time when we need the highly authoritative voice of Totenberg. She's cool-headed, always informative, and very fully explicatory. I really look forward to her reports. And this week, she prepared the ground for us before the case got heard on Wednesday. She set the scene incisively on the day itself, and afterward, she summed up all the proceedings so fully and doing something that the experts in Supreme Court reporting always have to do. That is, analyze just what individual justices might be getting at when they make their, each one of them makes their questioning interventions during the oral arguments phase. These of course, could give us clues to how each justice might vote, finally, when it comes to making a bench decision. I should say that in this vital Mississippi case, Totenberg is among the observers. If you look at the whole field right now, there's probably a preponderance of experienced observers who sense that the wind is definitely blowing in the court against upholding Roe versus Wade, something very troubling to people who believe in the right to women to choose. But she's quite rightly alert to one unknown at play in the Supreme Court at the moment, or at least a possible variable that could be at work. And that's something that I guess we should all be aware of, and we should be watching quite closely. The Chief Justice himself, John Roberts, is he or is he not, because he's concerned about the reputation of the court for non-political objectivity, that's what it's supposed to have, right? The very legitimacy that it is supposed to have in the eyes of the public. Because of that, he might be ready to join, as he has done occasionally in recent months, the liberal minority on the bench. This is tentative, this is speculative, but this is an eventuality that might help turn a potential 6-3 defeat for Roe into a possible 5-4 reprieve for it. I wouldn't bet on that heavily, but it's a possibility, and it would, of course, require another conservative justice to come with the Chief Justice, Roberts, and that doesn't look possible based on what Nina was explaining to us about the tone of the questioning from those conservative benches on conservative justices, members of the bench on Wednesday. But the speculation is that Roberts might be trying to engineer a compromise whereby the Mississippi state law is left in place, but the overall principle of Roe is somehow or other left intact. It could happen, but I guess it's unlikely. On the other hand, it has to be said that we just simply don't know what will go on in the privacy of the justices' discussion between now and next June, when a decision will be published. But about the media coverage in particular, which is why I single out Totenberg, in fanfaring her, we should remember what a giant of the profession she is, how as a complete veteran she has featured in the national scene overall. I think she together with another now retired veteran, Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times, have been responsible for all the public knowledge that there is, really. I exaggerate, but very largely responsible, double-handed, as it were, these two people for general public knowledge of the Supreme Court business. And we should remember that it was Totenberg's reporting, after all, 30 years ago now, that got the Senate confirmation process reopened into now Justice Clarence Thomas's nomination, that infamous case of the Senate having to double back and do its best at the time, such as it was, to reconsider Thomas's nomination because Totenberg had splashed the news of Anita Hill's accusations of sexual harassment against the nominee. And let me just finish with Nina on a lighter note. She's such a familiar and reliable voice and such a resonant name on the airwaves that she's figured iconically in NPR pledge drives. You might remember one of those little thank you gifts that the network and lots of stations would give people who make cash contributions to the pledge drive was in a very traditional manner a tote bag. Yes, you get your tote bag from the radio, and in this case it was renamed in her honor the NPR Toten Bag. Good bit of marketing there by someone.
You know, it's interesting that you said this, because earlier this week I read the story and I listened to her commentary, and what I think the Chief Justice is trying to do, he'll succeed in he'll come up with a plan that he'll propose something that will gut a portion of it but keep the law intact, and will it get through? Probably not, but it will be his attempt to try to hold the view of the Supreme Court together. He whether you agree with his decisions or not, and some of them I do and most of them I don't, I give him credit. He has held the Supreme Court together now for the past 4.5 years, that's what he's going to try to do here. And you're right, will he get that extra justice to come with him? I don't know. I don't think so, but I think he's done an admirable job in the face of the fact that he's a conservative and he's trying to keep the justices out of the political fray.
Trying his best, I guess. But these are, you know, this is overall, these are serious times for this extraordinarily divisive issue. I was speaking with a German colleague a couple of days ago. He's scratching his head, as so many foreigners do. Why is, amongst all the economically advanced countries of the world, why is the United States so divided on this issue, which doesn't divide many other countries, any other countries that we were trying to put our heads together and make comparisons? And it's another example, not a good one, I don't think, of American exceptionalism. It has such a dividing and contentious effect on the political. The whole political scene is tinged with this, and as we know, over the last 10 years in particular, it's gathered extraordinary. The argument against Roe v. Wade has gathered so much momentum that the very thing that the the pro-abortion lobby has been fearing is now with us, the very real danger that something almost unheard of in jurisprudence generally in America, that a Supreme Court decision so settled, as I was saying before, is in danger of being overturned.
It's an interesting view from the outside. You look at the United States and the major issues that divide us are guns, abortion, and now, unbelievably, our elections. It is a cancer that is spreading to all parts of what politicians have to deal with, and it's something that sooner or later this country will have to deal with in a way to tamp down the explosiveness and just move on. Hopefully, as a country that can get through this, the pendulum. I'm 69. The pendulum swings many different ways, and it takes a long time. But this particular period we're living through is simply amazing. Is all I can say.
One bit of American divisiveness that you didn't mention is, of course, the response to COVID. Situational. I mean, just come up with this one particular devastating pandemic. That is not exactly unique to the United States. We see lots of protests in other parts of the world, countries where people are resisting restrictions and lockdowns and mask wearing edicts and such like. But there is something particularly nasty, it seems to me, about the the debate. Oh, it's not really a debate. It's an extraordinary sort of stubbornness on the part of those people who don't want to see COVID it would appear that they don't see COVID as serious as it clearly is, and that the measures to fight it aren't as vital as they clearly are. But the moment, it's interesting to look just over the last 12 months how momentum for mandates have been increasing, and we see the publication yesterday, the announcement from the White House, from the President himself, of his plan for the winter, tightening up more and moving in the direction that some other countries have been doing already. It's quite extraordinary to look to Europe and see that one country already and a second country is about to join it in making vaccination mandatory for everyone. Quite an extraordinary move, and it's not as if Germany and Austria, the countries I'm talking about, Austria's already taken that step, and its fellow German-speaking country, near neighbor, Germany itself, has made it very clear only yesterday that that's the direction the country is moving in, just as Angela Merkel retires and hands over to the new Chancellor Scholz. That's the plan. Germany is going towards a complete compulsory mandate for vaccination for all adults. These are striking and stern measures, and that seems to be the way, because of all the indications that this pandemic is capable of taking the kinds of twists and turns that require the most severe of measures. And anyone interested in public health would want to see that be the momentum that the whole world carries. It's said again and again, and it doesn't get any less true just because it becomes so familiar, that we won't all be safe until we're all vaccinated. And that means everybody in the poor world as well as the rich world. And so far, we haven't done a very good job of that. And inevitably, and we see this in fits and starts, and the Biden administration's move yesterday is another one of those fits and starts, that we have to move towards a situation where it's a given that vaccinations are used, and every other instrument in our battery of weaponry against this disease have to be employed as well.
You know, what's different now, in my opinion, is that there's always been people that have been don't believe in vaccinations, and they truly don't believe in it. But what happens now is you have people that politically don't believe in vaccinations, and then they criticize and make fun and antagonize people who do believe in vaccinations, and then in response to people who do believe in vaccinations, criticize and respond in kind against them, and it's out of control. You know, that is part of the social media and the social fabric of this country that is out of control on every single major issue, whether it's racism, whether it's the vaccine, whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's abortion. You know, people just can't let their opinions be their opinions. There has to be these huge fights and these huge demarcations.
Yeah, but at the same time, the mechanism is clear. I guess New York City, where I'm speaking from, is an example of that. When mandates and such like are brought to bear, and an awareness, a strong public education effort is made, you get changes. The city employees here, for instance, I mean, there are people who are dragging their feet. That's clear, and rather remarkably, it includes police officers. There are 6,000 NYPD officers who are declining. They are are refusing, in fact, to take a vaccination, although it's mandated for them. But on the whole, with city employees overall, there's when the mandate was brought in, and you either get a vaccination or you stand the chance of being suspended from duty, and that concentrates the minds of a lot of people. And you had a late rush to the vaccination booth, what it makes me think of is that while everything that you just said is absolutely true, it's also true that, if you remember, there was a body of opinion in America that didn't want to see seatbelts made mandatory in cars, and now that's a forgotten issue. There may well still be people who feel it's an infringement of their personal liberty, and they just won't do it. But on the whole, that kind of refusal to do something for the public good because of your own sense of your own personal liberty has been overcome by custom and practice. And I hope that going to be the pattern that's followed now. Although, as we look at it right now, the bitterness that you're describing does tend to make that look rather unlikely.
I want to bring up something. I'm not sure if you're aware of the story, but this to me is a scary story, and this does bring fears deep into me. And that's, of course, it originates out of Florida, where the governor there has proposed a new civilian military force that he and only he alone would control.
Yes. DeSantis, the governor of Florida, is a force to be reckoned with, I suppose. An individual who clearly wants to stir things up. Let's put it at its lowest, I guess. Making mask mandates illegal in the state, which is essentially what he's done, is another mark of that determination to be stubborn, obstinate, stir things up. And in this case, one can only assume that he's concerned about somehow or other using that argument of states' rights, the age-old tension between central federal government and the rights of individual states to do things their own way. is attempting to even the balance, if you like, between the feds and his own powers as governor of an individual state. The idea of having a force of his own is deeply disturbing. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I'm heading to Florida next week, by the way, so when I report in this time on Friday next, we'll have more to say about it, I'm sure, and it'll become clearer what DeSantis thinks he's up to. Well, I'm not sure if that's the case, but the impact of this proposal is going to be a lot more clear, and we'll talk about it then. But it certainly doesn't have a good look to it. It has that smack of little sort of sniff of secessionism about it that must make anybody who knows American history react a little gingerly.
Yeah, it's you know, when I look at what's going on with the DeSantis and with Donald Trump, DeSantis really is pointing towards the next presidential election.
Oh, you think?
and it's
you could be right.
And it's amazing. It's amazing because he is in a way going to out Trump. He's going to try to out Trump Donald Trump. But
he won't be the only one either, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think he's practiced well at it, and
oh sure,
and
yep.
And if there's any hope the Democrats have about the midterm elections, it'll be that maybe the Republicans will finally turn like Democrats and fight one another and destroy their own inter-party faith.
There's a certain amount of speculation going on in the media also that will stir into this same pot, that while the abortion issue might be very dispiriting for many on the left or a liberal outlook, what may also happen is that the very threat to the woman's right to choose is going to galvanize Democratic voters in a way that has not often happened in midterms when the Democrats are incumbents in the White House and Congress. So we may see a very, very vital and very intense campaign as the November 22 election day approaches.
And I'll ask you a final question. As somebody who travels a lot and is a U.S. citizen, but of course spent so much time abroad, these travel bans that are being put into effect, can travel bans really be successful? And how widespread do you think they'll get?
Well, it's a very pointed question right now, especially with the Omicron variant having been identified in Southern Africa and eight countries in that region jumping straight to the top of the list of countries that the United States, for instance, although they weren't the first, Britain was the first to put a travel ban against those particular countries. Other countries followed suit, and the United States did so quite soon after the discovery. But it's sort of ironic, and certainly those Southern African nations are very upset by it because the two countries in particular, the lead countries of South Africa and Botswana, were the countries whose very skillful infectious disease scientists discovered the Omicron variant in the first place, and they gave the world this new knowledge and gave us a heads up which everyone's scrambling to find responses to. And now, of course, we also have more and more evidence coming out from South Africa in particular about the extraordinary extra transmissibility, if that's the right word for it, the infectiousness of this new variant. But at the same time, what's becoming very clear is that it's a form of disease that this variant induces is much less severe. That seems to be the pattern that's emerging. Very infectious, but not so severe in its symptoms. But the point is that the very country who puts its hand up and says, hey, there's something important that everybody should know here, that country and its fellows closely around it gets slammed with a travel ban. Already, of course, it's too late. I mean, travel bans also suffer from the slamming the barn door after the horse has bolted syndrome. Already here in New York City, 5 cases already of the Omicron variant, and there are 5 states all in all where the cases are occurring. It is too late, in a sense. I mean, what's going on now is community transmission, that is, transmission between people in the United States already. The travel ban's not going to make any difference to that. Is it going to snuff it out? No, it's not going to snuff it out. So the idea of a travel ban looks more important than it really is. It's almost like gesture politics, and I'd say that the powers that be need to think again carefully about the wisdom of doing this, because in the long run, which country anywhere in the world is ever going to put its hand up again and say, hey, we know something about the coronavirus that everybody needs to know, but we're not going to tell you, because if we tell you, you're going to stop our citizens from ever coming to your countries. It's a difficult notion, and I would say that I think many countries have been awfully hasty about this, and it could have been handled a different way.
Well, it's always interesting to see what's going on around the world and take a look at it with the Media Beat. David, have a safe trip to Florida, and how long are you going to be down in Florida?
I'll be reporting back to you for just 1 week.
All right. Well, have a safe trip down there, and we'll speak to you next week, David.
Thank you.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio, and you can hear the Media Beat every Friday live here on Robin Hood Radio. But we have the whole catalog of all the Media Beats up on our on-demand site, as well as other shows. So if you miss something, or you want to catch up on something, or recheck something, robinhoodradio.com, click on on-demand, and on the on-demand page, you will see all the shows listed on the right side. You can click on those links and go back to whatever shows you want to peruse. The Media Beat at robinhoodradio.com, and of course, David's own website, themediabeat.us.